Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to another episode of Your Own Personal Beatles. My name is Jack Pelling, and with me, as always, is...
It's me, Robin Allender.
Hi, Robin Allender, how are you?
Yeah, good. Yes, good. How are you doing?
I'm not too bad. For sort of going through the sort of minus life stress of moving house, but it's all good.
Mm.
So I haven't had much time to get stuck into Beatley life as I usually would, although yeah. I have now got the Ross Benson Paul McCartney book that we mentioned last week.
So yeah, that arrived for me as well the same day. I haven't quite got into that yet. There are so many other books in the world, you know.
Yeah.
But I think I might dip in for some comedy.
You really need an extended period of free time to like knowingly read a bad book, but hopefully there'll be some gold in there
over
the remaining episodes of the series.
Yeah.
We've got a fantastic episode coming up with Hazel Wild, who is from the band Lanterns on the Lake, who were this week nominated for the Mercury Music Prize. It's a really lovely chat, actually. Lots to talk about, including getting into Magical Mystery Tour and the Frog Chorus as an entry point to the Beatles. Talk a little bit about Britpop and post-rock and other formative things. And it's a really lovely, gentle chat.
Yeah, and it was really interesting to talk to her because we spoke to her kind of just before the award was announced and Michael Kiwanuka won in the end, which is another fantastic album. But yeah, there was that kind of slight sense of anticipation about that chat, which was quite nice as well.
Yeah.
And she talked about the kind of the amazing experience of that, having worked in a band for, you know, 10 years and then to get this recognition feels very kind of richly deserved. So that was kind of really nice as well.
Yeah. And such a great year to be nominated. It's almost a prize in itself to be shortlisted amongst some of those records because... Mm. The Moses Boyd record, Kiwanuka, Laura Marling record, all some of the strongest contenders we've had in a while. So, yeah, amazing. And if you want to check out their album, it's called Spook the Herd, and it's available on Bella Union now, everywhere. It's fantastic. One of my albums of the summer.
Yeah, it's really good. And I think, as I say in the episode, it's kind of been a very consoling album for the kind of current situation we find ourselves in. It's kind of obviously wasn't intended to soundtrack a pandemic, but it seems to have kind of
done a good job of it.
Yeah, that's great. I love it. It's very atmospheric, very beautiful as well.
So that's a great chat. We'll be talking to Hazel in just a minute. But have we got any correspondence to go through this week?
Yeah, well, first off, I just want to give another shout out to Gavin Libot, who wrote to me. He's written into the show before, but he's written to me because he's actually...
His food puns, I remember.
He was food puns, yeah. But he's written to me because he's actually covering the White Album for just arranged for solo guitar. And it's brilliant. You should check him out on YouTube. He's really, really good. Gavin Libot. And, including Helter Skelter. I haven't got around to listening to that one yet, but his arrangements of Dear Prudence and Julia are really, really good. It made me, I kind of picked up the guitar and learnt Dear Prudence this week, which was fun. So, yeah,
very
thanks.
Difficult, Dear Prudence.
It is.
I would say probably the hardest Beatles song to play on the guitar.
Really?
I don't know.
Well,
say.
The thing is with Lennon's finger picking is Julia's really hard as well because you have to kind of copy the exact pattern that Lennon's doing with his fingers, whereas McCartney is quite strummy on Blackbird, so you can kind of play it anyway. But it doesn't sound right unless you're playing Julia or Dear Prudence exactly like John played it. So that's kind of hard in that sense. But also had another nice message from Elizabeth Mizon, just introducing me to that band Black Rabbit. Have you heard of that band? It's kind of...
I don't think so.
So they kind of went viral a couple of years ago because they're on the New York subway covering 8 days a week.
Right, okay.
That was absolutely brilliant. Maybe we could play a little clip of that because it's really, really good. Yeah, that's worth checking out.
We'll play you out with it at the end.
Yeah, sure. And also thanks to my friend Wes White, who sent me the article about Keira Knightley, who explains that the Beatles are her secret parenting weapon, that her kids are obsessed with Magical Mystery Tour and all the other Beatles films. But this comes up in the episode with Hazel, doesn't it, that she was obsessed with Magical Mystery Tour from a really shockingly young age.
I know. Yeah. I think she says in that article that she shows them all the films, and it's probably not a great idea to show your your toddlers Help. In I think we can sort of lay that to rest in the annals of time.
Yeah, that's probably not a good idea, is it?
Yeah, unless they're old enough to understand the concept of time and changing cultural values.
Yeah, it's quite. That's a complicated lesson to teach, isn't it?
Yeah, for a toddler.
Yeah. But have I ever told you my magical mystery weird story? When I was on holiday in Cornwall in 2002, I met a strange man on a train who said he knew Roger Taylor. Because Roger Taylor lives down in Cornwall.
He lives in Falmouth, yeah?
Yeah, he lives in Falmouth, yeah. So I got the impression that maybe... Do a lot of people say they know Roger Taylor in Cornwall?
Well, I was just about to do my Roger Taylor claim to fame.
Go on.
My dad sold him his house in Falmouth.
Really?
Which is the only reason I know why he lives in Falmouth.
Well, quite good.
There you go.
But another thing he said on this mad train journey, he's one of those people who just starts monologuing at you. You know, it wasn't a conversation, but...
Yeah, I mean, usually someone to give a pretty wide berth.
Yeah, but he also said that he was in Magical Mystery Tour. And I never watched Magical Mystery Tour until we started doing this podcast. So I was looking out for this man. And I think I spotted him because he said something about he was wearing a brown jacket. And there is a guy wearing a brown jacket in the Blue Jay Way bit where they kind of go into the pile into this tent. And in the tent, it's actually a big kind of, it's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside, like the TARDIS. And they go in there and watch the Blue Jay Way film, and I think that might be the madman I met on the train.
Might well be. Yeah. They did shoot all of that around Newquay.
Yeah, yeah. So story
checks out.
It's
definitely filmed in Cornwall, yeah.
I mean, it's a weird lie to tell someone, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's that great bit in the Ruttles where they do the tent gag from Disney's Robin Hood.
Oh, yeah.
Where they all run into the tent and... run off the other way, which is actually very well done and better executed than anything in the actual Magical Mystery Tour film.
Yeah, that's funny. I thought you were going to say the tent joke from Austin Powers then, where it looks like weird.
Yeah. So if you want to get in touch with us, then share any of your sort of formative or personal Beatles stories, you can email us at jack@homespunsounds.com or go to personalbeatles.com/contact. As always, if you want to support the show, we are very, very grateful if you do so, and it really does help us keep going. We've got some excellent guests coming up for the rest of this series, and we hope to be back with more. So if you want to ensure our survival, you can go to personalbeatles.com/donate and help us cover some of the costs. And we'll be incredibly grateful for that sort of support. And thank you so much to everyone who has done so. You can also get in touch with us or just follow updates on our social media channels, which is at Personal Beatles on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. And you can message us there and we'll do our best to get back to you. For now, here is the fantastic Hazel Wild.
So this week we're delighted to be joined by Hazel Wild from Lanterns on the Lake. Hello, Hazel.
Hello, how are you doing?
Very good. How are you?
I'm very good, yeah.
Good. It's good to see you again. I think the last time I saw you was Bristol, Colston Hall, maybe?
Yeah, I think it was back in maybe 2015 or something like that. Yeah,
around that sort of time. But
so was that, who were you touring with there? Was that?
Oh, I was just, I was
or were you just a punter?
A fan, weren't you, at the front with the banner?
Fan. Yeah, indeed.
Nice.
But yeah, you did a tour supporting Jan, which is where we first, Jan Tiersen, and that's where we first met, wasn't it? About 2011.
That was like our first tour, actually. That was like our introduction to touring, was that support tour, yeah.
That was great. It was, I felt bad because at the time Jan had so much equipment on stage. And to fit all the five-piece band into this kind of...
There were six of us at the time. We had, for some reason, we insisted on taking all the instruments on tour. So, like, we had a harmonium, acoustic guitars, all the electrics, all stuff like that. We didn't bother sharing things. We just took everything with us, which we did learn from that mistake. But, yeah.
That was great.
So would you be touring now under normal circumstances?
Yeah, we had a tour booked for April. We put an album out in February, and then we had a tour booked for April. Obviously, that got cancelled. Rescheduled it for September. That got cancelled. And then, the European dates, we didn't even get around to announcing. It was just like, this is just pointless. Just scrap and it.
Are you kind of planning on 2021 dates, or is it, you know, when you're rescheduling the third time, it's a bit, it feels like, is this going to happen at the moment?
I know, but yeah. you feel a bit of pressure for, like, the promoters and stuff like that, don't you? Because, they're relying on the shows for the income, and you do want to make it happen eventually, and obviously people have bought tickets and you really don't want them to return those tickets.
Yeah.
So we have got one booked in for February 2021, and I don't know, at the minute it feels like that's becoming, it's getting further and further away in a way. We've just got to see what happens and hope for the best.
Yeah. And it's a shame because it feels like a real statement kind of album, and then obviously congratulations on the Mercury nomination.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
And it feels like this could have been your year, as it were, to kind of really take this album out on tour and everything. So sorry, yeah, I'm just pouring salt on the wound there, aren't I?
That's been the weirdest thing, was like we spent ages on this record and then put it out. And we did do a couple of launch gigs, but they were stripped down sort of things, not proper gigs. And we hadn't played live properly for ages, and we were dying to just go out and play the record. And then it comes out, and then everything just kind of stops in the way of live music. And then, so there's this disconnect then between you and the people listening to the album. You're not really sure how it's going down properly.
Yeah, but I found it's one of those, I mean, I love it. I think it's brilliant. It's we should say it's called Spook the Herd as well. It's out on Belly Union now. But for me, it's been one of those albums that I found really comforting this year. It's somehow, maybe it's, it's kind of seemed to fit the mood, and it's been kind of, I know you didn't intend it to be a kind of pandemic record.
Yeah.
But it sort of has been kind of, it's kind of, I found it quite consoling, I think.
Yeah, I think that that's happened for a lot of artists. I think that put records out this year, they didn't mean for it to fit with this context, but in this context, they just kind of work. And that's definitely the case with ours, I think.
So was it, and you were saying you hadn't played for ages, and I read somewhere that you were almost, was there a point where you were considering not kind of continuing, or was it kind of, it never really came to that? But
I mean, it wasn't that we didn't think we'd continue. It was just when you've been going for ages and ages and put out, this is our fourth album now. And we felt quite tired, and I personally felt a bit tired of just doing the, making an album and then tour and then make another album kind of thing. So we just took a bit of a break, which turned out to be, probably the healthiest thing we could have done creatively, definitely for myself, just to not have that pressure of working on something.
Yeah, you certainly sound very energized on the records from that. But was it kind of inspired by our times, for want of a better way of putting
it? Yeah, it was. I mean, I always say we don't sit down and try to make a concept album or anything like that, or plan what we're going to write songs about. But I think you can't help but let what's going on in the world seep into the music that you're writing nowadays. I can't imagine how that happens.
Totally.
So is this new bunch of songs the impetus for getting it all back together again? Had you written them and before you just made that decision?
I mean I was writing songs just for my own pleasure, really, not for a Lanterns album, just to write them. And and then I think Paul heard us playing one of them and was like, right, we're nicking that and we're turning that into the next Lanterns album. So I was a bit unsure about turning them into Lanterns songs, but actually I think it really helped with the band, because because I hadn't been thinking they were going to be Lanterns songs, it made them feel a little bit different, and we approached them a little bit differently.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, there's this progression you often see with bands where when you know you start and everything, you know, the vocals are much more buried and everything, and and it's kind of relying on more reverb and then and become more direct. And I think that's that seems what this album is. It's kind of your voice is really clear and direct in the mix and everything. Not that I've got a problem with things being unfocused. Unfocused is my middle name, but but it definitely seems to be that progression where it seems like you've grown in confidence and like you're actually really that, you know, the lyrics seem to have more of a, you're kind of addressing something rather than kind of creating a mood, as it were.
Yeah, I think that we're probably guilty in the past. I was definitely guilty in the past of just saying, yeah, just a bit more reverb, mate. Just like turn me down, definitely turn everything else up. But with this, we spent quite a lot of time actually just stripping a lot of stuff out of it and trying to keep to the bare bones and like making sure that every melody and every little part in there had to serve the song. And I think that helped the vocals shine through, and I get the impression it helped the meaning behind the lyrics come through a bit better.
Yeah.
Yeah, I absolutely loved it as well. I've been listening to it loads over the summer. Yeah, when did you hear about the nomination for the shortlist?
It was like a week before it was announced, so I had to live with this thing for a week. It was nuts. Our manager sent us a text message and she was like, can I just ring you? I've got some good news. And obviously at the minute there's no good news going on, so I'm like, well, what could it be? It can't be about a tour because there are no tours.
Yeah. Trump's using one of your songs.
Yeah, for his campaign. Just kidding. And I knew like the Mercurys were being announced the following week, and that did pop into my mind, and I quickly pushed that away and thought, nah, that wouldn't be that. But it was, lo and behold, it was.
It's so good, because I just feel like having followed you now for like best part of a decade, it feels like you've worked so hard and all your albums are so kind of well crafted, and you put the effort in on touring and taking a big band on tour, and it just feels like that's all that work's paid off, you know, with this, which I think is really inspiring, you know, because even pre-COVID it's hard to tour.
Definitely. I feel like I've talked to like quite a few indie artists or artists that aren't huge megastars and stuff, who have all said this news of us being nominated for the Mercury has really motivated them and inspired them. And I just think it's really cool for other bands and artists to see us getting a small amount of recognition when we've been working so hard for a long time. And you kind of think like that's not going to happen, you know, when you've been working for so long. If anything, you kind of, as you go through your career, you get talked about less and less and less.
Because there is this obsession with new, isn't there? Newness.
If you've not of shined really brightly on your debut album, then forget it, kind of thing. Yeah. But I actually think some of the best, I mean, we're doing a Beatles podcast here, some of the best bands are ones that develop over time, aren't they?
Yeah.
And they actually, their first albums aren't always the greatest, and it's, you know, by the time they hit album 4, 5, 6, that's when they really come into their own.
Yeah, it's true, isn't it? So, you know, if you think of the kind of trajectory of bands, there was this idea of the kind of firework band kind of thing, of like a big push behind the first album and then kind of dipping. But like the Beatles, I suppose it's funny with the Beatles, because I suppose there was so much focus on sales, as in, so like try and do one or two albums a year.
Yeah.
Keep it ticking over so they could develop in that sense.
Out for Christmas.
Yeah. I suppose it wasn't necessarily easier, but it was just such a different landscape, wasn't it? You know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I didn't realise till I was watching something not that long ago. I hadn't realised that they were putting out like two albums a year, like every 6 months an album, or every few months a single. And that's just, I can't imagine that now.
Yeah.
Especially like some of the singles that were sort of forced out that should have been on records, and, you know, no one had the forethought to think, maybe if, they're writing things like Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields, then we could make a pretty good album out of this. They're just, get it out.
Yeah.
We'll we'll start at the beginning of the Beatles. Like, what are your first sort of Beatles memories growing up?
I mean, there isn't like a first memory for me because they were always a part of being a kid. They were always there, and you know, like kids nowadays watch that film Frozen all the time. Me and my little brother watched Magical Mystery Tour. That was our film that we had on all the time,
really?
Which is a little bit insane and quite trippy for kids to be watching that.
That's interesting. I read a thing where you said, you know, when you like a song, you listen to it and like hundreds and hundreds of times. So was there a similar thing with Magical Mystery Tour?
I think it was just like being kids, that was our favourite film. So we would just put it on all the time. I'm surprised that it didn't completely mess us up, to be honest with you.
Because it's not exactly kind of quotable in the way like Hard Day's Night is or something.
No, it's not.
It's so weird, yeah.
Yeah.
But,
did you have any sort of idea of who they were, or was it just like four for funny men and lots of bright colours singing really catchy songs?
Well, there was like the Beatles as in the songs and this backdrop of my childhood. Like, for example, I think it was my fourth birthday or Christmas, I got one of those little Fisher-Price tape players with Paul McCartney, the frog chorus song, you know that one?
Yeah. I can't believe that hasn't been mentioned yet.
Yeah, it should have been. It's a classic. Yeah. So they were like always, and back in the USSR was like our favourite song to put on in the car and just like bang your head to. But then I remember the moment of realising who the Beatles were and realising that they were this band and what they were all about, which was I think I had tonsillitis or something like that, and I was off school. I must have been about 8, and my dad had left a cassette, VHS, in front of the telly, and I put it on, and that was Hard Day's Night. And I remember being like, oh, okay, they're like, that's a band, and that's something that you can do when you grow up. You can be in a band. And that was quite exciting, yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. Oh,
that's great.
Were there any particular songs in that? Because a few people have cited the actual band scenes in Hard Day's Night. Was there any particular song that you remember?
I can't remember the watching it and remembering a song, but I do remember the scene where, isn't there one where one of them goes to collect the other outside their house in the car?
Yeah, that's them.
Is that Hard Day's Night? Right at the beginning,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that was really exciting, that just seeing that loads of people had that much passion for these men.
Yeah. Did you recognise them from Magical Mystery Tour?
I don't know if I put the two together. Like, I can't really remember putting the two together, but I definitely around that time started realising who the Beatles were, yeah.
So what did you take? How old were you with watching Magical Mystery Tour obsessively? Was that quite young?
I guess I must have been, yeah, maybe about 6 or 7, something like that. Yeah. My dad was a massive fan.
Yeah, oh, okay, yeah. It's so weird what you latch onto at that age, because like me and my dad showed us Nuts in May, you know, the Mike Lee film.
I don't know that one. No.
Oh, it's great. It's very, very funny. But it's like not the kind of thing 10-year-olds get
into.
But like me and my brother just we used to watch it like all the time, like know every line from
really?
It.
Really? It's so weird, like, isn't it?
You wouldn't. Yeah, but Magical Mysteries, because I only watched it sort of for the first time from starting doing this podcast, and I really like Magical Mystery Tour, but it's got such a bad reputation because, you know, the hubris of, am I pronouncing hubris right? But, you know, they showed it on primetime slot on Boxing Day. So it was just such a kind of, you know, they were just asking for it to be slagged off because it's so kind of all over the place and improvised. And
yeah, and it's so crap as well, really.
Yeah. It's really like a student film, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Lots of long shots and kind of things that don't go anywhere.
I think probably in starting your sort of Beatles life with Magical Mystery Tour and the Frog Chorus, you've probably chosen the two most maligned historical artifacts.
You're
the only way
right.
is up from there.
Yeah. What songs did you kind of respond to on Magical Mystery Tour then?
Well, I Am the Walrus.
Yeah.
Definitely. Well, Strawberry Fields, just.
That's not on the film, though, is it? Or is it? I can't
remember. Is it not on the? Is it an album? Is it classed as an album or is it an EP?
Yeah, they kind of put them all the two EPs together with those tracks on it. Yeah.
I mean, I can't really remember the music from the film. I can just remember the bizarreness of the film.
Yeah.
But then, like, as I've got older, I've listened back to Magical Mystery Tour and enjoyed those songs. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that was they released an EP, which was all the kind of I Am the Walrus. It was a double EP. I Am the Walrus and Blue Jay Way and Flying and everything. Yeah. And then when it was released as a full album, it was like, let's put Strawberry Fields, Penny Lane, All You Need Is Love. That's a really good album.
How did your love of the Beatles then transfer into like your teens and getting into music?
I mean, the Beatles was kind of like always there as a band that you listened to, even though you fell in and out of love with other trends and stuff like that. They were always part of the mixtapes and stuff that you made, weren't they? And then obviously I wanted to form a band, and I think I was probably influenced by how much I saw that, like, they kind of changed the world with what they did.
And whereabouts did you grow up? Was that in...
So, yeah, I was born in North Shields, which is where I live now, and I lived in a place called Whitley Bay until I was about 10, I think, and then back here. So Whitley Bay is like when I was growing up, it was kind of a really tacky seaside town that people went to on holiday.
Yeah.
Or got drunk at, yeah.
So were the Beatles quite cool then when you were growing up? Because what I find really interesting is talking to lots of different people is that a lot of people had a period where they were either rejected or had to like pretend to reject the Beatles in their teens because they were sort of uncool and then came back to them later. But for you, they always stuck around.
Yeah, I think they were always quite cool. And like when I was at school, Britpop became quite a big thing. And obviously Oasis made the Beatles cool again, didn't they?
Yeah.
So it was kind of all right to like them as I was growing up. And then just as a teenager, I was just really into John Lennon and... really pathetically had made a bed peace sign that I stuck behind my bed like an absolute loser. I just thought it was so cool.
Yeah, that was great.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Happens on the lake has got very... what I've always admired about the band is it's kind of they don't seem to exist as part of any kind of trend or movement that's happening now, and it's kind of got its kind of own sound. And you can hear kind of shoegazy post-rock kind of elements in it. So where did that kind of influence come from?
It's funny because loads of people ask us about shoegaze influences, but we were never really into shoegaze bands. Like, I think I kind of missed out on that a little bit.
I was definitely kind of getting into music around Britpop or just after Nirvana, and I was just after that wave of the kind of Slow Dive and The Cure and My Bloody Valentine kind of stuff. Although I got into them later, it wasn't really there at the time.
Like when I was in a band to begin with Paul and Ol, who are in London's now, and we were looking back, we were really shoegazy, but we just didn't have that as a reference point at all. And I remember loads of reviews of the band were like, they just really wear the heart on the sleeve. It's very obvious that they're influenced by shoegaze. They're just churning out the same old shoegaze. And we were like, what's shoegaze? Like, we thought we'd invented this whole new genre, and it definitely wasn't new.
Was that kind of pull getting into effects pedals or relying on reverb? And
yeah.
How was it? How did you inadvertently discover shoegaze?
Yeah, I think it's something to do with definitely the effects on Paul's guitar. Mm. I remember that we did used to really like that first Verve album, A Storm in Heaven, which I guess is quite shoegazy, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Maybe that was the only shoegaze record that we really liked. Yeah, and then there's something about that effecty guitar and then vocals with a lot of reverb on that people... Mm. Oh yeah, that's shoegaze.
Yeah.
Is that probably the same kind of comparison with the sort of post-rocky instrumentals, textural sort of Explosions in the Sky type?
We were definitely influenced by Explosions in the Sky. I mean, I feel like that's kind of obvious.
Did you tour with them?
Yeah, we did. Because we were massive fans of theirs, and then. We ended up signing to Bally Union, which is obviously their UK and European label. And then this tour came up supporting them. So obviously we were absolutely starstruck. But they were really canny. They were really nice lads.
They're incredible. I always thought, because I got into them sort of very early on. They were still on their sort of second record when I was at university, and I remember being a bit scared to go and see them in the Broodnail Social Club because it was, I don't know if you've played in that venue, I'm sure you have, Little Room in Leeds. And I was like, how the hell could they recreate the sound of that record in this room? And I mean, exceeded all expectations. They were absolutely, I mean, whenever I am asked that impossible question of best gig ever, that's one that alternates around the top spot.
Same for me, I think.
They were, when I was in Gravenhurst, the first tour I did with Gravenhurst was supporting them, and they were so nice. They were lovely. Just incredibly generous.
Yeah.
I mean, considering I knew absolutely nothing, like, barely knew how to turn an amp on. They were lovely.
Yeah, I'm the same, Jack. I think my one of my favorite gigs is seeing them for the first time. It's just such a intensely emotional experience, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think that was a huge thing for me, and John Robbins, the comedian, like when we first started going to gigs and we saw Godspeed You Black Emperor at the Fleece, which is absolutely tiny, it's smaller than the Broodnail, and Godspeed would, like, you know, it's almost like a full orchestra or something. Well, it felt like it, you know, two drummers and strings. And that would just blew me away because, you know, from coming through the 90s and just seeing guitar bands to suddenly having something so orchestral and textural and, you know, dynamic, it was absolutely mind-blowing,
I saw them once in at the Sage in Gateshead, and halfway through one of the songs, the fire alarm went off. So, like, the whole of the audience had to leave, and they were all stood at the back, at the side door, at the fire escape with the band. And they're, like, having a fag and, like, chatting away. And then they came back on and just started again where they'd left off. Yeah.
Really? One, two, three. Yeah. Do you know that story? It's quite funny. This is a very 90s. But when Mogwai were doing a live show on BBC, like maybe the evening session, and Radio 1 had a policy where if the sound level went under a certain limit, they would kick in with an emergency song, so they'd assume something had gone wrong. So they're playing a song, really quiet bit, and then they just kicked in to Roll With It by Oasis, which is great. You know, you had that Britpop era where obviously the Beatles were such a touchstone, but then you start getting into more experimental music, but then the Beatles always stayed there as part of that because you hear elements of, you know, you hear the influence of them in so many different kinds of bands.
Yeah, definitely. Like even the different versions of the Beatles separated off, didn't they, into and became genres of their own. like definitely bands like Cooler Shaker and stuff like that. Took what went down one path with them.
Good old Cooler Shaker. So were you quite into the Britpop scene? Were you sort of the right age for it?
Yeah, I mean, I was bang on the right age for it. Oasis were like my favourite band when I was, I don't know, 14 or something like that, 15 maybe. And that was kind of the band that made me realise that it was quite easy to write songs. Like, you didn't really need to know that much about an instrument. You could just know a few chords and you'd probably get away with it.
What did you grow up playing? Were you a piano player or guitarist? Or?
No, I only started playing piano a few years ago, actually. I just learnt guitar. I didn't get lessons or anything like that. I just, I think there was an acoustic guitar in my house and I just got one of those three-chord guitar song books and learnt some songs from that.
Any Beatles songs?
Yeah.
Probably none that I can think of right now,
It's weird that learning to play the guitar, it's sort of, you know, that's the thing that with the Beatles is obviously they started with such rudimentary chords and everything. I remember one of the first things I had to teach was I got this enormous chord sheet from a guitar shop that I put on my wall. But it was all like ninths and diminished sevenths. And I was like, I can't know that. I've got to start with three chords. Yeah. Don't start with a ninth chord. And I think that's been my downfall, really. You know?
I think that's what the Beatle, the big gold Beatle books are a really good one to learn from because it's in chronological order. And so you sort of can get more complex by the time that...
I also had a like Beatles for Buskers book, like a little kind of A5 size book, Beatles for Buskers, and I had Tomorrow Never Knows.
Oh, wow.
One chord.
It was just C. Just play C.
Wow.
So you started writing your own songs then and on the guitar, and were they do you have any fond memories of those early songwriting efforts? Were they very Oasis-y or were they
I mean, I probably only used chords that Oasis used at the time because they were the only ones that I knew. They were fairly simple and probably quite embarrassing if I heard a copy of them now. I did get like this four-track recorder and start recording stuff, and I'm glad I've never come across that tape, but I do wonder where it is. Started writing songs like that and then was kind of desperate to join a band.
One thing we're quite interested in is first band names. What was the name of your first one?
Well, when I was maybe about 14, 15, I tried to form a band with two friends of mine and I wanted us to be called Harmonize, but with a Z.
Cool.
And I had a really good logo that I'd drawn out. I was really, really excited about this band, but I think it wasn't really going anywhere. I was the only one like pushing for things and the others just weren't pulling their weight. So,
Was it one of those bands you form at school, which is a band sort of in concept only?
Didn't ever play any songs together or I think I was the only person that played an instrument, but it was a good idea and we had a name, so that's, you know, that's half the battle, isn't
it? Technically my first band was a band like that. I think we had one sort of 10-minute practice and then the rest of it was just playing, planning which pubs in Reading we were going to play at. But we were called Addiction, but the plus sign at the beginning. So it was
plus
Addiction.
Add and then maybe Diction or
Addiction.
It was very bad.
Addiction.
I think Addiction. So it was like because I knew from my singing lessons that that Diction was a thing to do with music. Technically it would have had 3 D's, but that was the least of its problems. Well, we went around on on New Year's Eve trying to find a gig for to play the Millennium. And weirdly no one took us up on the offer.
I remember the John and I were in a band called Koyaanisqatsi.
Called what, sorry?
It's a film that Philip Klass did the soundtrack to. It's a really good film, but if you're like a pretentious 17-year-old, it's a really terrible band name.
Yeah.
But it's a great film where it's kind of lots of sped up footage of kind of cities and natural kind of
time lapse,
you know, sunsets and things. Yeah. Time lapse, yeah. But with this kind of intense Philip Glass soundtrack, it's really good. But I was, yeah, we were obviously terrible as a band. But the first gig we did was in the Rummer in Bristol, and John just insisted that for one song we wouldn't play, and he'd do one of those Brian May guitar solos with delay.
Oh wow.
And just like, we were just standing there, and he was smoking as well at the time. And then we were supporting another band from school, and we got really drunk, and we started heckling them.
Aww.
Even though like they'd asked us to support them. just really didn't know the rules.
I think the general rule is don't slag the band off that you support, and
yeah.
also
yeah,
don't slag off the sound engineer either. I've seen people start like kicking off with the sound engineer during their first song stuff, and it's like, what are you doing, mate?
Yeah.
Like, everything is in their hands.
So what was the beginnings of Lanterns then? Were there a few iterations of it before?
Yeah, so me, Paul and Ol were in a band, which was another absolutely awful band name called Green Space. One word.
I quite like Green Space.
I don't know.
It sounds like a sort of county council directive.
It does, yeah. It was one of those things where, like, you need a band name because you've got a gig next week and they need it for the poster. So we settled on that one. We did do quite a lot of stuff. Like, we did put out a mini album and a single and stuff like that, and then the bass player quit, so we were like, right, well, we'll show him, we'll form a new band and we'll become absolutely massive in your face. So yeah, we started Lanterns about 2008 or something like that.
Yeah. And did you send him a copy of the Mercury nomination?
I am still friends with him. He did message and say,
he's the Pete Best
congrats.
So is the current lineup, are you all Beatles fans?
I think we all like the Beatles. Yeah, I do remember actually when I first met Paul, I was having the Beatles conversation, and he was like, because he came from the kind of Nirvana kind of era, and he was like, oh, no, I don't like the Beatles. but now he admits he does love the Beatles. I think we're all fans, and like, there's definitely been times where we've tried to do Beatlesy things on recordings that we've done, like, you know, the big day in the life piano chord at the end of a song, and little tricks like that, which we never pull off in the same way. But
because a lot of before this album, didn't Paul produce all of the records? Kind of recorded them himself.
We recorded all the albums ourselves, and Paul has always mixed them, and he mixed this one as well. But it was the first time it went into a studio.
Right. Oh, wow. So how was that?
Was it different? Well, it was weird to have somebody else there, and like somebody else seeing what the process was for us, and kind of letting somebody else in on that bubble, which was Joss, the sound engineer. It was his studio, but it worked really well, and actually we recorded it much quicker than we would ordinarily, much quicker than we have albums in the past.
Yeah, I think recording at home, there's that kind of temptation, well, I can do 1,000 takes of this, and
definitely. We were always trying to, in the past, I think, like, pile more stuff on songs, or like perfect takes, and actually it was better to just play it as if you're performing it.
Kind of Beatles thing, and another thing, a factor in how they were able to work so quickly, is that they just started to use Abbey Road as the place to play, you know, new songs and to play kind of.
Yeah, and you can feel that, and like, you can feel that energy, can't you, in their music?
Yeah, that they're kind of not learning them, as it were, but that a lot of the time you get the sense that it's new and it's kind of exciting. There's a lovely bit in Let It Be where Paul McCartney's taking them through the dreaded Maxwell Silver Hammer. Paul's doing the kind of, okay, B minor, A, G7 now, like this, kind of so over the top. And John Lennon, then it cuts to John Lennon doing Dig Me a Pony, and he's just playing it, just not saying anything, just like wants everyone to pick it up and everything. Yeah. So which are you, Hazel? How do you communicate the song? How do you, like, how you want it to sound to people?
I think we all have, and I think all bands have a bit of a weird band language that you develop between each other, don't you? And
yeah,
we definitely have our own way of communicating. And like, for example, with the first song on this album, I remember saying, like, this bit needs to sound really lagoony. Like, it just make it sound like really lagoony and like lagoon. Mm, and great. Then I remember people doing stuff and I'm like, nah, it's just not lagoony enough, man. We need it more lagoony. Yeah, so we definitely have ways of trying to describe things.
I think John's famous one, George Martin, always brings up is John wanted to make it sound more orange, whereas Paul McCartney would be like, da-da-da, and then the horn does this and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. And Tomorrow Never Knows was he wanted to sound like a kind of monk shouting from a mountaintop or something.
Wasn't it? Wow.
Oh, great. Yeah, okay. Give me half an hour.
Yeah. Bit of reverb, is that right now?
I was listening to Tomorrow Never Knows not that long ago, and it's like amazing how, even if that came on the radio now, you'd be like, and it was a brand new band, you'd never heard it before, you'd be like, wow, that's it. Like, it still sounds brand new, doesn't it?
Yeah, it stops you in your tracks, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And it's still, it's still one of those ones that you find more and more in it, the more that you listen to.
Totally. The thing I'm always struck by is how, considering, you know, they were using tape loops, you know, as we've discussed, obviously not the first people to use tape loops, but, you know, considering they were using this technology, which would have been new to them, it's still incredibly melodic.
Yeah.
And the way the lines come in and out work with the kind of melodies. So it's not going into noise or anything like that. It's still incredibly rich kind of melodic world in that song. You know,
must be a lot of happy accidents.
It does sound like almost like somebody's remixed a Beatles song, do you know what I mean?
Sounds like it could be on that Love album, and two different songs mashed together, and because it sounds so weirdly slowed down, and there I think it is very sped, but not as much as you would think. But it's interesting what you're saying, like, about recording at home versus the studio, because we were talking quite a lot about Rubber Soul the other week, and in next week's episode we talk about some of the things that are just wrong in that record. And it's really interesting that the Beatles, the greatest band ever, have so many slips in a lot of those unbelievable records. There are quite a lot of things that are out of tune and out of time. And, you know, if they were recording that material now, it would all be kind of fixed or, you know, nudged together done in...
But also, a man of genius makes no mistakes. His errors are volitional. They're portals of discovery, you know, as James Joyce famously wrote.
Yeah. But no, there you go. That's mistakes, basically what I was trying to say.
But we were listening to Revolver the other day, because Simon Love, a listener of the show, hello, Simon, was tweeting about how he couldn't believe Josie Long wasn't a fan of Yellow Submarine. But we're having a chat about what is the least good song on Revolver, and I've never been a massive fan of I Want to Tell You, the George Harrison one.
Oh, right, yeah.
On the second side, and that's one where the backing vocals, they're really reaching.
Yeah. Are they? I've never noticed that before.
And it's got that really weird wonky piano. I've never been a fan of that.
Are you the sole writer in the band, Hazel?
I'm the one that writes all the words, and I tend to cut, like with the most recent album, I wrote a good chunk of the songs, but there's a couple on there where we kind of wrote it together, Paul came up with a melody on guitar and we kind of fleshed it out together.
So you don't have any sort of loggerheady Beatle moments?
I've definitely said, let's just do whatever you want to do, Paul. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Nice that he's called Paul as well.
Yeah.
I had a really lovely moment today listening to the album, because the last song on the album, A Fitting End, has got the line, when time held me green, which is from Dylan Thomas.
Yeah, that poem, Fern Hill. I love that poem, yeah.
Fern Hill. And this is probably, too much information, but it was my grandmother's funeral yesterday, and I read Fern Hill.
Wow.
My grandma lived in near Carmarthen all her life, basically, and So it was, I thought it'd be a nice poem. As I said, I don't think she would have approved of Dylan Thomas's lifestyle. Yeah. I think she'd like the poem. And so it was really straight. I was listening to the album again today, and that suddenly just sprung out at me, you know. And it's just such a, it's such an incredible poem, you know. And it's so vivid and it's so strange as well.
It's beautiful, you isn't it? Sometimes, like, I feel emotional thinking about that poem and that kind of just youth slipping away and yeah.
Yes, yeah. And that, it is that kind of, it's about that loss of innocence, isn't it? It's kind of, everything's kind of painted in this beautiful landscape of almost mythological discovering the world. And yeah, and it's about kind of growing up and,
Oh, as I was young and easy in the mercy of his means, time held me green and dying. Though I sang in my chains like the sea.
And it, but another kind of weird link as well is that, you know, I got hold of my copy of Dylan Thomas's poems to you know, find it before the reading, and the first thing that leaped out at me in the intro was Dylan Thomas was the favourite poet of the Beatles, and
it was
all kind of coming together. Yeah.
Devouring the magic when time held me green. I want a door to the 90s. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, I get the sense as well, because there's another lovely line in this which really strikes a chord with me, is I want a door to the 90s. And so was that song kind of a nostalgic thing?
I suppose it's a way of escaping all the other stuff that's on the album, and it's this kind of, like, great escape song, really. Getting away from all the heavy stuff that's in the world now and, like, social media and all that kind of thing, and getting back to, a time when things felt more real. And for me, that was when I was, like, a teenager in the 90s. And, so that Dylan Thomas poem about... you know, that kind of longing for that innocent time, and then also a daughter in the 90s kind of.
I suppose, yeah, one of the preoccupations of the album seems to be a kind of to do with social media. Although what I like about the album is it's not kind of explicitly political, for want of a better word. There's no ha-ha Mr. Wilson, which does tend to date us.
Yeah.
But, you know, so was that a concern, the kind of social media thing when you were writing the album?
It's such a big part of life now that I can't really imagine it not featuring somewhere in the songs that I'm writing about. I'm surprised there's not more songs about social media, really. It's part of everybody's life.
Well, Robin has decided to call it quits with Twitter this week. Has that been a consideration for you?
And I have quit it a few times. I say quit like I've, like, deleted it off my phone, but not, you know, left it. But you're a good Twitterer, Robin? Is that the word,
I just think it makes me feel so sad all the time, you know. And it's just, you get into the habit of checking it every morning, and it's like you wake up feeling all fresh, and then 10 minutes later you're like, oh, God, I feel awful now.
Sometimes.
Like, you know, there's a fraction of, obviously, you know, you hear great music, great jokes, and there are great people to follow. But I'm just finding the negatives outweigh the positives, particularly in our current situation and climate.
Definitely, and Facebook's kind of the same. Like, sometimes it can put you on a real downer, can't you? Because you discover this whole dark underbelly of people's weird opinions that, and you're just like, I can't believe that people actually think like that,
that's the thing, is the going down rabbit holes of people, you know, to see what kind of the worst people are saying. Let's see what the worst people are saying about this, you know. That's kind of the bad habit, and particularly in this time, like, one of the, you know, an element of COVID that is also bad is obviously how it's it's almost like another Brexit, isn't it? Where it's another cause
it's
of division.
It's another part of the culture war. Yeah, definitely. And these some of these conspiracy theories that even massive pop stars like Ian Brown and stuff are getting involved in, and it's pretty grim, isn't it?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of depressing. And, you know, someone made the point, like, where's Ian Brown been on any other, like, major political issue for the last 20, 30 point, years? Yeah. But all of a sudden you can't wear a mask in Marks and Spencer's. It's like, right, making a stand here, you know.
Did you listen to his song?
No, I don't. I can't quite bring myself. I can't bring myself to listen to the Van Morrison.
I haven't heard that one.
Yeah. I listened to the Van Morrison ones at the weekend.
What's the Ian Brown one like, first of all?
It's not good, like, to sum up.
Imagine if it was amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you could forgive him for some appalling opinions if it was quite catchy, but it's just really not good at all.
And what's the Van stuff like?
The Van Morrison one it's not really music. He's completely abandoned any type of...
That sounds good. I like stuff like that.
I mean,
is it like the Metallica and Lou Reed album?
I mean, it's basically like he's reading out a badly written sort of press release. It doesn't rhyme. Mm. There's nothing, you know, it's like a sort of very rushed Dead Riggers sketch with a particularly adept Van Morrison impressionist. It's very weird, but I was intrigued because it got 3 stars in the paper at the weekend.
Oh,
it's like, okay, really? Right, I'll actually go and have a listen to this. But no, yeah. I mean, we'll play a clip of it. Actually, no, we won't.
Don't bother.
But that's the thing. I think the weird thing about the Van stuff is a lot of people, it brought a lot of people out of the woodwork saying, oh, well, I've never liked Van anyway, it's rubbish. And it's like,
no.
Part of liking Van is that there's so many stories about him being an arsehole. And he's this enigma, you know, where how can he make such beautiful music and be so
such
unpleasant, seemingly? But, like, Astral Weeks is my favourite album.
Is it?
You know, some of the early, the 70s records are brilliant, just so good.
There was one of the most damning things I saw on Twitter was someone who said, I think he interviewed or something, and he walked into a round table interview, and just someone offered him a packet of Maryland cookies, and he just ate the entire packet without offering them to anyone.
I saw that one. Yeah, it's a bit like Ringo when he was offered his first joint, wasn't it? He didn't know he had to pass it on, so he smoked the entire thing.
So we always—I forgot to ask you our stock question for this week. But one question we all ask everyone who comes on the show is: do you have a controversial Beatles opinion?
I mean, if I'm totally honest with you, and I think this about most bands and artists, there's a couple of stinkers, at least one or two stinkers on every album, isn't there?
Yeah,
I think so. Yeah,
broadly fair to say. Yeah.
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 So yeah, maybe that.
And any stinker in particular? We've had a lot of people who've dragged up things like Obladi, Obladar.
Oh, I was going to say Obladi, Yellow Submarine, Maxwell's Silver Hammer, not keen on that one. I mean, they're mainly Paul McCartney ones, if I'm honest.
Yeah, that's true. He's there. I think they're the usual suspects.
Yeah, definitely.
That was Hazel Wild from Lanterns on the Lake. So do check out that album, Spook the Herd, on Ballet Union. And that was a really lovely chat.
Yeah, it was fantastic. A real shame that they didn't take the big gong. But, you know, it is, you know, usually people say it's an honour to be nominated. But I think in terms of the Mercury 2020, it really is a huge achievement, especially because they've been plugging away. So it's fantastic for them. Well deserved. And definitely check out the album. It's absolutely amazing.
Yeah. And I think as well, is that like she said in the interview, that thing about, you know, kind of people are obsessed with newness, and it is really good for a band to be recognised on their fourth or fifth album, you know, to kind of, you know, it's, I think that was really nice for a band like that to be recognised, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. And I really enjoyed going back to some of those records we talked about since we recorded that. And I went through to try and find the ticket stub, because I've kept every ticket stub to every gig I've ever been to.
Really?
And I have a huge photo album, and I was looking for the Explosions in the Sky gig that we'd mentioned at the Broodnail Social Club, and I found it, and I completely forgot that it was a double bill with Explosions in the Sky and Fortet.
Oh, wow.
And it went on for ages. It was absolutely incredible. Mm. Also, the guys who run the Broodnail Social Club said it was the best gig that they ever had at the Broodnail. So
yeah,
I was quite pleased to
that. I love the Broodnail. They've got an excellent selection of crisps there.
Really?
They really do.
I remember they used to sell Tato's, the Irish crisps.
Yes,
Tato's. Quite hard to find.
Yes, these nice Indian spiral crisps. You can get them in Sainsbury's.
Very nice. It's an amazing venue. They've got a second room there now. So if you live in the West Yorkshire area and things get back to normal. The other thing that I realised from doing that is that I actually saw the Explosions in Sky 3 times on that tour and saw them 3 days after that gig at the Garage. So I was like, didn't remember being that obsessed with them, but obviously I was.
The first time we played with them, it was Gravenhurst, as mentioned, and the first gig was at the Astoria, which is closed.
Yeah.
That was a brilliant venue, wasn't it, the Astoria?
Love the Astoria. R.I.P. Yeah. Hopefully we won't lose too many more iconic ones through this absolute shit show. Mm. But thank you so much for listening to that episode, and we will be back with a really exciting episode next week where we're talking to the author of the upcoming book, Fab Fools, Jem Roberts, and the legendary comedian and George Martin impersonator, the actor Kevin Eldon,
who has
written the foreword to it and is a huge Beatles/Ruttles fan.
Yep.
So there's loads to talk about the Beatles and their comedy and Neil Innes and the Ruttles, one of the most enjoyable ones we've done so far.
It was brilliant. And also, I think that was the one where there was proper kind of nerding, wasn't there? I mean, because we haven't... You know, most of the podcasts have been quite tangential, but that was one where there was a lot of, you know, I really had to do my homework for that one. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I had to read the whole book, which was delightful.
You didn't want to just accidentally say, oh, you know, the B-side of Eleanor Rigby was, you know, you didn't want to get that wrong.
Yeah, and you also don't want to do that thing that sort of Radio 2 DJs do where they talk for an hour about a book which they obviously haven't read. Like when Kevin Bacon used to do his Five Live show, just try and wing the fact that he had read 5 pages of a book. Apparently he used to be, when he was a film critic for the Daily Mirror, just after he got sort of, I think it was one of his first jobs sacked from Blue Peter, and he just never used to go and see the films. Just used to go to the Groucho Club and make up all the reviews reading the IMDb page.
Wow.
Which I think he says in one of his books, but I just thought, what an extraordinary thing to do.
Yeah, that's a shame, isn't it?
But, don't know how we got on to
it. No, it's fine.
Did I say Kevin Bacon or Richard Bacon?
You said Kevin Bacon, so I was
Richard Bacon. Yeah. Would have been quite weird if Kevin Bacon was reviewing films for the Daily Mail.
Do you remember when Beth Ditto? Oh, she's still about.
From The Horrors?
No, The Gossip. Was it
The Gossip? Yeah, yes.
And she was once given a column in The Guardian about, crafting.
Right, remember that.
And it was just
upholstery or something.
Yeah, and she only did one. She, did curtains. And then it was curtains for her. Well, she obviously ran out of ideas.
Yeah, fabric.
I like the idea. Yeah, we'll give you a column about this. Yeah. Oh, Christ. Yeah, and then she just pretended, Richard Bacon, she just sort of invented craft.
Yeah, next week, doilies.
Doilies, yeah.
good stuff. Right, well, thank you very much for listening. if you enjoyed the show, the last 2 minutes excluded.
No one listens to this bit anyway, do they?
It's true. Well, it goes down to about 30% of people get to this point, so and completely justifiably, if this is anything to go around. But it's late, and we've had a few cans.
Yeah.
So thank you for listening. If you did enjoy the show, please give us a nice 5-star rating. That really helps people find it and massively appreciated. And we'll be back next week with Jem Roberts and Kevin Eldon.
See ya.
Your Own Personal Beatles is presented by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. The podcast artwork is done by Morgan Ritchie. It's produced by me, Jack Pelling, and is a Homespun Sounds production.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.